The anathem started simple, then got almost too complicated for the ear to follow. When we'd had an organ, it had required four organists, each using both hands and both feet. In the ancient Ought, this part of the anathem represented the chaos of non-systematic thought that had preceded Canoas. The composer had realized it almost too well, since during this part of the music, the ear could scarcely make sense of all the different voices. But then, sort of as when you are looking at some geometric shape that looks like a tangle having no order at all, and you rotate it just a tiny bit, and suddenly all its planes and vertices come into alignment and you see what it is, all of those voices fell in together over the course of a few measures and collapsed into one pure tone that resonated in the light well of our clock and made everything vibrate in sympathy with it. Whether by a lucky accident or by a feat of the praxis, the vibration was just enough to break the seal of static friction on the winding shaft. Leo Arcibald, Jezri, and I, even though we knew it was coming, practically fell forward as the hub went into motion. Moments later, after the backlash in the gear train had been taken up, the meteorite above our heads began to creep upwards. And we knew that 20 beats later we would expect to feel the day's accumulation of dust and bat droppings raining down on our heads from hundreds of feet above. In the ancient liturgy, this moment had represented the light dawning in the mind of Canoas. The singing now split apart into two competing strains, one representing Deot and the other Hylea, the two daughters of Canoas. Trudging counterclockwise around the shaft, we worked up to a steady pace that fell into synchrony with the rhythm of the anathem. The meteorite began to rise at about 2 inches every second, and would continue to do so until it reached its upper stop, which would take about 20 minutes. At the same time, the four sprocket wheels from which the four other chains were suspended were also turning, though much more slowly. The cube would rise by about a foot during this Ought. The octahedron would rise by about an inch, and so on. And up above the ceiling, the sphere was slowly descending to keep the clock going during the time it took us to wind it. I should stipulate that it does not really take so much energy to run a clock, even a huge one, for 24 hours. Almost all of the energy that we were putting into the system went to run the add-ons, like bells, gates, the great orrery just inside the day gate, various lesser orreries, and the polar axes of the telescopes on the Starhenge. None of this was in the front of my mind while I was pushing my pole around and around the hub. True, I did look at these things afresh during the first few minutes, simply because I knew that Artisan Fleck was watching, and I was trying to imagine how I might explain these things to him, supposing he asked. But by the time we had found our rhythm, and my heart had begun to thump along at a steady pace, and the sweat had begun to drip from my nose, I had forgotten about Artisan Fleck. The chanting of the one-offs was better than I'd expected, not so bad as to call attention to itself. For a minute or two, I thought about the story of Saint-Bly. After that, I thought mostly of myself and my situation in the world. I know that this was selfish of me, and not what I should have been doing during the Ought, but unbidden and unwanted thoughts are the hardest to expel from one's mind. You might find it in poor taste that I tell you of what I was thinking. You might find it unnecessarily personal, perhaps even immoral, a bad example for other FIDs who might one day find this account sticking out of a niche. But it is part of this story. As I wound the clock on that day, I was wondering what it would be like to climb up to the Warden Fendant's ledge and jump off. If you find such a thing impossible to comprehend, you probably are not avowed. The food that you eat is grown from crops whose genes partake of the All's Well sequence, or even stronger stuff. Melancholy thoughts may never come into your mind at all. When they do, you have the power to dismiss them. I did not have that power, and was becoming weary of keeping company with those thoughts. One way to silence them forever would have been to walk out of the Decenarian gate in a week's time, go to live with my birth family, supposing they would have me back, and eat what they ate. Another, would have involved climbing the stair that spiraled up our corner of the minster.